such stirring music. Peter and Leon are on the road again. We are delighted to be invited to the Canadian Critical Care Forum in lovely Toronto. It's snowing outside. I just want to say it's 10 above in Edmonton. That is the national anthem for those of you not from Canada, but let's be honest, this is the unofficial Canadian national anthem. There we go. Okay, on to proper work. I am absolutely delighted to not just invite, but to re-invite and re-welcome Professor Hannah Wunsch. We've had her on before talking about Autumn Ghost. We're going to dig further. She is a professor of anesthesiologist at Weill Cornell University, formerly of the University of Toronto, massively missed by every Canadian coast to coast to coast. And rather than give a big, long bio, because we did that before, I'm going to turn it straight over to you, Leon.
Thank you so much, Peter. Hannah, thank you so much for joining us again. Last time we spoke, you gave us a very neat rundown of the history of mechanical ventilation and how we got about ventilating patients with positive pressure. At that time, which we didn't really get to, and as Peter said, we're going to delve a little bit deeper, I noticed from your book as well that there seemed to be sort of a parallel development of positive pressure and negative pressure ventilation, depending on where you were in the world. In Europe, it seemed like positive pressure ventilation was the way to go versus America or the US, where things were negative pressure ventilation mainly. Take us through that.
Yeah, so there's sort of two parts to that. The first is the fact that sort of the early development of positive pressure ventilation, a lot of it was focused on the operating room and the need, particularly for thoracic surgery, to have positive pressure ventilation. And so a lot of the development actually occurred in places like Sweden. And that was really in the kind of 30s and 40s. And at the same time, the real focus of negative pressure ventilation was in the United States. And that really was driven by the development of the iron lung, 1928, and the fact that it was developed in Boston, so I'm sure they were happy to call it their own. Mm-hmm. But iron lungs were incredibly successful for treating patients with polio who had respiratory paralysis. But there's a couple things about them. And one thing is that they were very expensive.
Right.
And one place that had a lot of money to support the development and use of the iron lungs was the United States, mm-hmm. mostly because Franklin Delano Roosevelt had developed polio, or we think he developed polio. There's a little bit of debate. Because of that, he became a huge fundraiser with the March of Dimes and the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis. And it really became a model for fundraising for a disease. And with this success came enormous amount of money that was put towards research, but was also put towards purchasing of iron lungs and support of patients and the rehabilitation of patients as well who needed support after polio. Because of that, iron lungs were readily available in the United States and much less so in Europe, primarily, I think, because of the cost. So you do see this embracing of negative pressure ventilation in this kind of wholehearted way, and they became comfortable with it in the U.S. They had big respiratory centers. You see these pictures of kind of a room full of iron mm-hmm. lungs. And so I think as positive pressure started to develop and it was sort of shown proof of principle in the 1952 epidemic in Copenhagen that it was a successful way to ventilate people, there was a reluctance in the United States to embrace it. And I think that just speaks to having something that we're comfortable with, having something that's been used for a long time. So for instance, there was a polio epidemic in mid-1950s in Boston. They were still using the iron lung. And they did eventually switch over, of course, and I think that was, you know, the kind of slow recognition that positive pressure ventilation was a more efficient and effective and better way on average to be ventilating people and for a wider range of problems. It protected the airway, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
I'm just going to hopefully not throw us off track here because I want to dig this seam of negative versus positive pressure. But you've just fascinated me with a comment. Roosevelt might not have had polio. I thought that was done and sorted. Yeah, what's the differential?
Done and dusted, right? There's an entire book that's been written about did he have a Guillain-Barré?
Mm.
You know, I've I'm not fully convinced personally. You know, there's a detailed deconstruction of his symptoms, the timing of them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We'll never know. And one of the reasons we'll never know is they didn't do a spinal tap on him at sort of the right time to confirm polio, which was really the only way for the ultimate confirmation. But you know, I think it's sort of, it's kind of irrelevant in a way, right? Because polio was a common disease. It was one where he became identified with it. He certainly had residual symptoms that were consistent with it, broadly speaking. And so it is this kind of fascinating side note, the idea that, like, wait a minute, this guy who becomes the kind of poster adult for polio may not have had it.
Nice use of poster adult. Okay, back to the negative pressure, positive pressure. So are we stuck in our lanes now?
You know, I don't think we're ever really stuck in our lanes. I mean, certainly there was an embracing, or has been a huge embracing, of positive pressure ventilation. But of course, there's always ongoing research into other options. And other options right now, of course, have been expansion of thinking about non-invasive ventilation that is still positive in nature, but is certainly different from intubating people, which was, of course, the norm for a long time. But then you do see research that's been coming out slowly looking at negative pressure ventilation again. And we've really kind of come full circle. And there's some, you know, interesting papers out there in the last 10 years that have looked at what is the potential benefit of something that actually is more physiologic, right? Of course, in terms of how we breathe. You do, of course, always have this issue of the airway and protecting the airway, as we love to perseverate on in anesthesia. But I do think that in the future, we may see more of it again and used in different ways. It's not going to be the old iron lung.
What a perfect segue to my next question. How did the US, or then with iron lungs or negative pressure ventilation, how did they overcome the airway issues? Because as you pointed out, there was bulbar polio and spinal polio.
Yeah, they didn't. There was 90% mortality with bulbar polio. And I think it was one of these things where it, you know, it's sort of nihilistic, right? You just accept the fact that some portion of your patients are going to die, no matter what you do for them, and that was bulbar polio. Now, of course, 1949, there is this one group in Los Angeles, and I talk about them in my book because they were influential, where they added positive pressure to negative pressure. And they're really sort of proved, they dropped their mortality for bulbar polio from 90% to 20%. And so there was experimentation with the idea of finding ways to protect the airway and support individuals that way. But fundamentally, bulbar polio was still pretty lethal, even with the iron lung. And I think that, you know, there were a lot of things that were just accepted, of course, you know, because they didn't have anything else to offer.
Right. With negative pressure ventilation, did they also have the so-called Respironauts?
The Respironauts, yeah. So just the Respironauts were named, given by some people, to those who ended up dependent on ventilators. It was primarily sort of seized on and used as a term for those who ultimately received positive pressure ventilation in the kind of 60s and 70s. But it was a real concern, actually, when the iron lung was invented in 1928. Apparently, there was this kind of gathering in the courtyard at Boston Children's Hospital, and the doctors talked about their concern of what happens if we put someone in an iron lung and they can't get out. We can never wean them.
Yeah.
And so even before they used it, this was something they were thinking about. And of course, it did happen. And there were people who were permanently living their lives in an iron lung. But they also couldn't figure out who those people would be. And this is something about polio. We never figured out who was going to end up with paralytic polio and then who wouldn't recover from paralytic polio. So they actually concluded, they said, you know, we can't determine who's going to benefit. So we have to offer it to everybody. There's a really interesting paper about that.
Isn't that incredible how quickly we went from how do we keep these people alive to how do we avoid just sustaining a poor quality of life?
Yeah.
Which kind of sort of maybe brings us to post-polio syndrome. Last time we spoke to you, and I'd strongly encourage people to A, buy 12 copies of the book, and secondly, listen to the interview again in all its crackliness. But we sort of touched on post-polio and then ended the podcast. So let's go.
Yeah, so I talk about this at the end of the book, and it's really, I think, in some ways the most important piece for anyone who's taking care of patients now, if you're not taking care of children, that is. You know, post-polio syndrome really was noted in the 1960s initially, and it was this constellation of symptoms of increasing weakness, pain, fatigue that seemed to be occurring in patients who had had polio primarily as children. It was occurring anywhere 15, 30, 40 years later. These were people often who had had full recovery and led what they felt were very normal lives, not in any way altered by paralysis or weakness, but who then subsequently have developed these symptoms. It's a diagnosis of exclusion, but it seems incredibly prevalent. Essentially, every single polio survivor I spoke to from the 1952 epidemic now has post-polio syndrome. Some are back in wheelchairs. I actually spoke with a man actually in the U.S., not from that epidemic, but who is back on a ventilator after having been in an iron lung for a few weeks back in the 1950s. So, you know, serious consequences for those. And to me, it's slightly terrifying, not just for those individuals who've had polio, but the more we think about these long-term consequences of viruses.
I was going to say, kind of puts long COVID in the shade.
Yeah, right, exactly. I mean, I think of long COVID as almost like the kind of residual paralysis from polio that it occurs up front. But this is like, oh God, what, you know, 20 years from now, what does it mean to have been exposed to COVID? And I think when you think about like Epstein-Barr virus and multiple sclerosis, or even, you know, shingles and chickenpox, right, which is just a pure reactivation, but there's so many ways in which viruses seem to kind of wreak havoc 30 years later. So I think we have a lot to learn from that. I also think, though, I always stop and now think about the patients I had trouble weaning from ventilators or who had some sort of respiratory complications after surgery. And you just think, if over a certain age, could that have been related to polio in their youth? That, you know, you were sort of unmasking weakness that was sort of subtle, but then got worsened by being on a ventilator, say, for surgery or critical care. And it's something I think I'll never know, but it's kind of fascinating.
Holy smokes. We're trying to encourage people to listen to this podcast, not scare the bejeebus out.
I mean, I've often now thought about, do I ask people if they had polio as children? If they're over the age of 65, there's a chance that they had polio. So I think it's an interesting piece to add to our history taking that we don't generally talk about.
For sure. Let me see if I understand this correctly. So how much do we really know about this? Is it a reactivation syndrome? Is it a reinfection? How can we test for this in the patient that you just described?
So the answer is basically no, and we don't know. most people don't think it's a reactivation. They haven't been able to isolate polio virus consistently from these individuals. The current best version I've heard of what's probably going on is that when people recover from polio, to whatever extent they're going to recover, whether it's totally or partially, the neurons that are left, the motor neurons, take over as much as possible and grow bigger. And because of that, the idea is a metabolic fatigue that occurs over time, and that those remaining neurons start to fatigue and die off. I don't think anyone has clear proof of that, but that seems to be the hypothesis that gains the most traction.
Yeah, that sounds a lot like the hypothesis for post-COVID syndrome, actually, that it seems to affect the mitochondria.
Yeah.
and fatigue being one of the major symptoms. Does the severity of your initial polio infection, does that have any bearing on the development of post-polio syndrome at all?
I'm not sure, mostly because there's so few good studies of this population out there. I think most people would say probably yes, that it has some relationship. That said, I was told the story, and I think I included in the book even, of the sister of one of the patients at the Blenheim Hospital in 1952, who was supposedly, you know, maybe had some sniffles type of thing, but is now in a wheelchair. And was noted later in life to have legs that were different lengths, which is sort of consistent with the fact that she probably had mild paralysis, but she was a little kid and focus was on her brother who was super sick.
Of course.
And so nobody noticed, she recovered. But the severity of her symptoms now, I find sort of shocking, because you think, oh, if it was so mild back then, how could she possibly be doing so, you know, having so much difficulty now? And so that's what always gives me pause when I say that there's a relationship, because I'm not really sure.
Worldwide scoop time, your sophomore book, anything you wish to reveal?
Yeah, well, I am working on one, so that's exciting. Very, very, very slowly. It's a new job and this book to talk about, which is always exciting. But something to do with tuberculosis.
Yeah.
I'm changing diseases to one which, you know, the more I read about, it's absolutely terrifying how much tuberculosis is still out there. And it's interesting to go from a disease that you kind of think of as dead and almost eradicated from the world, that we don't see or treat clinically, to a disease that is really alarming a lot of people in terms of the multi-drug resistance.
And I also assume you could do the history of the world with tuberculosis too, from trade routes to...
There's a lot to learn about tuberculosis, and so I'm doing a lot of reading. There's a lot of fascinating angles on it, and so I won't yet reveal what my angle will be, but it's pretty interesting to read about.
How do you find the time? All right, which brings us to how do you find the time to move back to the U.S., reestablish your life? Canada's huge loss losing you.
Well, thank you.
You've worked in both systems. The same? Different? So similar that you're surprised when they're different? Or so different that you're surprised when they're similar?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I would sort of say that, you know, I remember moving to Canada and kind of being shocked that it felt different. But the differences really are subtle, of course. And it's the same thing going back. You sort of, it feels the same and then it isn't. I'll be honest, the thing that I've maybe noticed most is the difference in spending. A lot less conversation and concern within ICU care around what are things costing, therefore, is it essential that we give it or not? There's more latitude and ability to just sort of prescribe what you want, do what you want, within reason. I don't want to, you know, make it sound like they're just doing things willy-nilly, but definitely it feels like a different culture in that regard.
Now, to throw that back at you, is there any chance it's just protocolized, you know, and then we do this and then we do that and you can't stop until 12 MRIs have been done? And then
I wouldn't say it's protocolized. I'd say it's culturalized. It's what people have been taught to do. And until someone stops them and says, well, do you really need that? And unless a lot of people are doing that at all levels, and, you know, of course, every hospital's interested in cost savings and U.S. hospitals as well, but it does feel like the conversations and the focus are a little bit different.
A very good Kiwi friend of mine, and that's certainly not a profligate nation healthcare-wise, talked about the dance, almost like a medieval dance where you hold the arm out one way and you kick the leg out the other way, and you have to do all steps in the dance to have done the dance. And this was his argument for why are they doing a CAT scan, even though we won't change anything, why are they doing this?
Yeah, I love that. I'm gonna remember that. Yes. Imagine this dance happening every time someone orders the CAT scan that I think is irrelevant.
Well, it's actually made this impatient man more patient when it comes to seeing the dance play out. And I probably sound like I'm dripping with cynicism. I'm not. I'm starting to slowly learn the complexity of the system that we all work within.
I mean, on the flip side, I would say it does seem like some things happen a little bit faster. Oh. Canadian system, you're sort of trying to explain to the family why this essential MRI hasn't quite happened as quickly as you would like. And it does feel like there's maybe, at least in the place I'm working, a little bit.
I think you're very kind to use the word maybe. I think we have some big issues to address. I've always thought the Americans do the Goldilocks patient better. The patient who isn't sick enough for ICU is too sick for the ward, but needs monitoring or BiPAP or
it sounds like it's not all that different, but it is very different.
Yeah, as I said, you know, it's like on the surface, it all feels the same, and it all feels familiar, and then you dig a little deeper, and you do, of course, come up with differences. What makes it fun?
Would you say that you have a bit more freedom? Is that safe to say in the way that you practice medicine, or?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. In some aspects, yes. I think there's, you know, a little bit more. They do love their gadgets a little bit more, I would say. And there's a lot of sort of focus on high tech. What was it? High tech, low touch. A little bit more, as was being described this morning, versus low tech, high touch. Yes, there's a bit more of that. I guess in that sense, maybe a little bit more freedom to kind of use drugs and things that maybe they're a little, you know, questionable, but you decide you like it, so you use it, and nobody's going to question you.
Hannah, this occasionally emotionally incontinent wasp is going to risk a question now. I love being at this conference, catching up with friends. It takes me back to when I was a trainee, and one of the people who took me under their wing was your late husband, Brian Kavanaugh. There are lectures named after him at this glorious event. How you doing? How does it feel? How do we keep the memories alive? Because what a force of nature that man is, was, and always will be.
Yeah, well, certainly some of the research on negative pressure ventilation was his, and his descriptions of putting rabbits in, I imagine, these little iron lungs. Of course, it didn't look like that, but that was the image in my head, was something that sparked my imagination and interest in the entire topic. And so, yes, I mean, he was an enormous intellect and a huge loss to many people, not just me, of course, in terms of the mentorship he provided. And I think that's probably the most important piece, and the one that he was most proud of was the mentorship he gave to many, many, many people here in Toronto and actually internationally as well.
Bravo. Well, thank you very much for your time, and thanks for sharing, and thanks for sharing the emotional stories at the end here and your expertise. This is always lovely to listen to you, and thank you so much for joining us again today.
Information offered on the Critical Care Commute podcast and the resources available for download through the podcast and show notes is provided for general informational and educational purposes only. It is not intended as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. The opinions expressed by the hosts, guests, or any individuals featured on this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the hosts or their employers.